Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Nature's waiting.
Wildfires are raging around the globe, in California, Western Canada, Greece, Italy, and even above the Arctic Circle in Sweden, where temperatures top 90 degrees. All-time record rainfalls occurred in Wisconsin last week and the week before. 15 inches of rain in just a few hours in Dane County, following a catastrophic rain event up north in June that washed away streets and businesses in the city of Houghton. This summer, Japan experienced a heat wave that sent 22,000 people to the hospital. 70 deaths were linked to a heat wave in Canada. A city in Oman posted an overnight low temperature of 109 degrees, a world record. The evidence of global warming and climate change is everywhere. I'm Glenn Mobrick. Today on Route 51, we're going to look at how bad it is, how bad it could get, and what we can do about it. We'll be focusing on what's happening to our lakes, rivers, and ecosystems in north-central Wisconsin, including Lake Superior, which has seen a blue-green algae bloom that stretched from Superior to the Apostle Islands. Our guests are two University of Wisconsin scientists, Michael Notaro, the Associate Director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison, and Catherine Clancy. She's a professor of water resources at the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. Now, you can join the conversation as well. Perhaps you've seen the effects of climate change playing out in the environment around you. Perhaps you've noticed that things are different in north-central Wisconsin than they were 30 years ago. Our phone number is 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a question on our webpage, wpr.org/route51, and I will read it live on the air. Michael Notaro, thanks for joining us today. You're at our studio in Vilas Hall at UW-Madison. You've researched this phenomenon pretty extensively. Is there any doubt in your mind that the Earth is getting warmer and human beings are a factor in it?
There's no doubt in my mind, and the vast majority of scientists in atmospheric science are consistently stating that the Earth is warming, particularly since the mid-20th century, and that it's related to human-induced emissions of greenhouse gases.
Well, I pointed to a lot of things in the introduction to the show: the California wildfires, temperatures above 90 degrees in the Arctic, those devastating heat waves in Japan and Canada, the record-setting rainfall here in Wisconsin. You know, I could have gone on. Hurricanes in Hawaii and Puerto Rico, warming ocean temperatures, the bleaching and dying of coral reefs. We often say that you can't talk about individual weather events and say that they prove or disprove climate change. But can you point to all of these things together as evidence?
Yeah, there's a whole discipline called detection and attribution in our field, in which we try to detect climate extremes and then determine to what degree we can attribute it to climate change. The general consensus is that you can't necessarily attribute a single event to climate change, but that the warming of the Earth tends to amplify these extremes. So some portion of these intensities and frequencies are attributed to it. So the climate change will generally shift your distribution, so you have more extreme events and more intense events. So those wildfires, heavy rain events, each of them can be attributed to the impacts of climate change to some degree. Each one is contributed by human emissions.
What has been happening to our global temperatures over the past few decades? What have the measurements by NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration shown us?
The global temperatures have risen about 1.5 degrees since the late 1800s. And obviously, regionally, it's bigger. That doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, within Wisconsin, we've had greater warming, and the high latitudes have had greater warming. But what we find for our planet is if you warm just a couple degrees, that the extremes can change quite a bit. And the other thing to keep in mind is the difference between our current climate and even an ice age was not 50 degrees. It was something in the order of 8 to 10 degrees. So these are substantial changes.
Let me run through some of the statistics that I just compiled. It's easily found on the web. If there are people who are skeptics who are listening right now, this is just what happened this year and last year. Los Angeles, an all-time record of 111 degrees on July 6th. Denver, an all-time record of 105 degrees on June 28th. Montreal, all-time record 98 degrees on July 2nd. Glasgow, Scotland, all-time record 92 degrees on June 28th. Shannon, Ireland, same day, an all-time record of 90 degrees. Tbilisi, Georgia, in Eurasia, July 4th, an all-time record of 105 degrees. Kirat, Oman, on June 28th, the hottest low temperature. That's the overnight low of 109 degrees, hottest temperature ever recorded for an overnight low in the world. Pakistan had the hottest temperature ever in that month for the entire world, 122 degrees. Dallas, which had never hit 90 in November before, did it three times in 4 days last year. On September 1st of 2017, San Francisco hit an all-time record of 106 degrees. And in July of last year, Shanghai hit its highest temperature ever, 106 degrees. The same month, Death Valley, California endured the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. So, Michael, this is happening all over the Earth. It's not like this is just a localized phenomenon.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you had actually alluded to some sites in the Middle East. There was a study a couple of years ago basically showing that parts of the Middle East by later in the century may become uninhabitable because it becomes so hot. And then potentially the Fertile Crescent region in the Middle East, areas that agriculture began in, may no longer support agriculture at the end of the century. But the evidence of climate change is global. I mean, we've seen the California wildfires. The western United States has become, since the late 1990s, has experienced very intense drought episodes. We've had springtime warming out west, and that's caused in a decline of snow cover, more and more wildfires. Locally, we know we've had more extreme precipitation events. We've known in the last couple of weeks we've seen rainfall amounts exceeding 12 inches. And that's because our water cycle, our hydrological cycle, is getting ramped up. The warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture and give you more extreme rainfall. So again and again, there's so much global evidence, both in the climate data and then also in the everyday things that we see, whether it's our lakes, our agriculture, our forests, our animals. You can see evidence across the board of this change.
Now, Catherine Clancy, you're a professor of water resources at UW Stevens Point's College of Natural Resources. Is there any doubt in your mind that the Earth is getting warmer and human beings are a factor in it?
Absolutely not. I've been basically teaching introductory climate change courses, and I've been watching, you know, how our warming has increased and as well as our evidence of it.
Now you were just out west recently and experienced the wildfires. Tell us about that.
I didn't experience them directly, but in Redding, the wildfires had started, that car fire that was started by a tire spark.
Right.
One of my friends, we were up about 2-3 hours away, and the air quality was so poor that you weren't allowed to go out without any kind of mask. And she lost basically her home, her family. My friends lost all of her family's homes.
And that's not an isolated story in California.
No, it's not an isolated story.
Now you've worked with other faculty members at UW Stevens Point to develop a field course that'll be taught in September. It's entitled Lake Superior Region, Natural Resources, Culture, and Climate Change. Tell us about the course.
Well, basically, it's getting at a place-based evidence of climate change, because a lot of people feel that climate change is anonymous, and they feel that it's, you know, if you're talking about global climate change, then they don't feel that it's very personal. But when you can go up and you can show people how this is going to impact their activities that they've done with their families, activities that they've done all their lives, how it's affecting their fishing, it's affecting their livelihood or the livelihood of others, that they directly experience that they have a different understanding of how climate change is real.
How seriously is Lake Superior being impacted by climate change? If you read the New York Times, just yesterday there was an in-depth story about a massive blue-green algae bloom that occurred this summer, something that used to be unheard of in the lake's cold, pristine waters. That algae bloom extended from Superior all the way to the Apostle Islands.
I've been going up to Lake Superior for over 10 years now, and I bring my students up there on a camping trip. And one of the things that was most disturbing to me in just the past 3 years was the amount of sediment that I would see in Lake Superior that I had never seen from runoff. The lake levels in the past 10 years are above average from like over a 100-year period.
So Lake Superior is dirtier than it used to be.
Substantially, yes, especially along the shorelines.
From the article, I'm going to quote here from the New York Times, the lake has been unusually balmy and cloudy with thick mats of algae blanketing the shoreline. I've never seen it that warm, said Jody Estain, a former Coast Guard member who guides fishing, cave, and kayak tours year-round. And he goes on to say everybody was talking about it. And the article says scientists generally agree that algae blooms are getting worse and more widespread and are exacerbated by the warmer water, heat waves, and extreme weather associated with climate change. So this could affect, not just ecosystems and wildlife. It could affect the northern Wisconsin tourist industry worth millions of dollars.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, we spent a week on Lake Superior near the Porcupine Mountains last June, about 2 weeks after the big rainstorm that hit the area so hard. I have never seen the big lake's water that filthy. And beaches were actually closed because of E. coli contamination from the storm runoff.
Yes. People used to drink that water. So it's I don't know that you'd want to drink it anymore.
We had another huge rain event on Lake Superior 2 years ago, which killed a man and washed away Saxon Harbor.
Yes.
And that harbor still hasn't been rebuilt.
Yeah, I've been up there, and I was up there right after the event, and the roads were washed out, and the money that was put in to repair the roads, they had another storm that came through and washed out a culvert. So, yes.
Lake levels seem higher than they have in the past. What is the prognosis? What's the long-term trend for the big lake?
In terms of the lake levels?
Lake levels and the general health and cleanliness of the water.
Well, the lake levels are increasing simply because of increased precipitation. And the ice cover is dramatically affecting the ecosystem. The ice cover is substantially less by more than a month now than over the past 100 years. We have also, the ice is fragmented. So you have less ice cover that's going to dramatically affect the ecosystem of the lake. There's warming at different levels of the lake that is unexpected. And also just the sediment erosion along the coastline.
Tell us a little bit about the erosion.
Well, the erosion is due to a number of things. One would be the seshes, which is sort of the standing waves that is a natural process within Lake Superior. You also have tidal surge, storm surge, and that combined with increased levels is going to substantially cause coastal erosion.
Michael Notaro, what's your perspective on the impact of climate change on Lake Superior and our other northern Wisconsin lakes?
Sure. You already mentioned about the algal bloom that took place. That tends to happen on more shallow lakes, even like Lake Erie. So it's very unusual that something like Lake Superior would have that. And that's kind of a combination of the fact that the lake's been warming, but also the heavy rain events in which the agricultural lands, their fertilizer is generated into runoff and providing phosphorus and nitrogen to the lake, which helps the algal blooms take place. The other thing is over time, particularly during the last, say, 3 decades, the lake's been warming more rapidly than the air. That's not necessarily intuitive, and it's a little surprising. And that's partly because the lakes are actually stratifying earlier, mixing up earlier than they usually do. And since about 1998, the Great Lakes in particular, especially Lake Superior, abruptly warmed. You can label it as a regime shift or an abrupt change in the climate. and that's gone along with a decline in ice cover and increase in evaporation. And that increase in evaporation during the last century or so has also contributed to more lake effect snow in a lot of the Great Lakes region. Now, part of the concern in that region, too, is that we've lost a lot of wetlands. I've sent an estimate that I think right now we have about 10% of the original wetlands in the Midwest region that we had from a couple centuries ago. And that has a large impact on the regional ecosystems. For example, we know that as we have less snow and ice and as we have warmer temperatures, that ducks tend to migrate later. And that increases some of their foraging pressures on the Great Lakes region. And loss of wetlands has a large impact. So as these ducks remain in the region and there's not wetlands to turn to, they have a reduced food supply.
Go on, please.
Yeah, so the impacts in Lake Superior, there was a study by Catherine O'Reilly in which she studied global lake warming. And most lakes in the world have been warming, but there's three hot spots. One of the three is the Great Lakes region. So Lake Superior is really like a poster child of extreme climate change.
If you just joined us, we're talking to Michael Notaro of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison and Catherine Clancy, a professor of water resources at the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. We're talking about climate change, its effect globally, and also its effect regionally and locally. Let's go to the phones right now, 1-800-780-9742, if you'd like to join the conversation.
Dan, that would be fine.
Well, I just lost Dan in Mosinee. Dan, if you're listening to us, please call us back. I pushed the wrong button. Please call us back, and we will get to you as quickly as we can. What I'd like to talk about right now is the fact that this issue has become politicized, and it never used to be political. It wasn't that long ago that both Democrats and Republicans viewed climate change as a national priority. Here's a public service announcement by former Speaker of the House, Democrat Nancy Pelosi, and former Speaker of the House, Republican Newt Gingrich.
Hi, I'm Nancy Pelosi, lifelong Democrat and Speaker of the House.
And I'm Newt Gingrich, lifelong Republican, and I used to be Speaker.
We don't always see eye to eye, do we, Newt?
No, but we do agree. Our country must take action to address climate change.
We need cleaner forms of energy, and we need them fast.
If enough of us demand action from our leaders, we can spark the innovation we need.
Go to wecansolveit.org. Together, we can do this.
Now, this is an ad that ran just in 2008, only 10 years ago. What has happened to our national consensus on the environment? How did science become a political issue, Michael Notaro?
Well, I could say within among scientists, the general consensus is 97% of atmospheric scientists understand that there's warming and it's related to human activity. Unfortunately, in politics, it's a different story. There's been an attack on climate science, and that's largely led to this largely attributed to this political divide that's occurring. And some of the impacts of that have been targeting funding, for example, for research from EPA and NASA, removal of information related to climate change attribution to humans on websites like the EPA, the elimination of Wisconsin's DNR Science Bureau. There's been many direct impacts in climate research. And unfortunately, we've gone to a point where we're not making a united effort to tackle the problem, which in the past we've had a lot of successes tackling issues related to ozone, acid rain. There was kind of a combined effort to attack some of those issues. But climate change has really become very political. Partly, I think it's because they want to – some politicians want to protect their industrial representatives, those who would have to make large changes that maybe they're not ready to make.
Let's go to the phones. We have Dan in Mosinee back with us again. Dan, thanks for being patient and calling us back when we disconnected you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for a wonderful program. My question, I kind of missed the question that the person before me asked because I was calling back. But it kind of runs along the same lines. I've been watching this for years. I've been gardening since 1974, and first frost used to happen this coming weekend, and now we're not getting killing frost until October. with all of the disastrous weather and related events related to climate change, it seems as though we ought to be doing something about it. We got to be reducing our carbon footprint. Electric cars, they're wonderful. Renewable electricity, wonderful. We can grow local food. We can put LEDs in our house. And yet so many of us aren't doing those things. And so I kind of look to legislation, and I'm trapped by what your guests were just talking about, this paralysis in government. And I would really like to hear their thoughts about, I would like to hear something hopeful. What can we do now to change the disastrous path we're traveling?
Jan, thanks so much for the phone call. Catherine, do you want to comment on that?
Well, that's part of the reason why we started this course, was to develop more of a personal understanding of climate change. We feel that when people can have a personal understanding and see the firsthand, like, for instance, your gardening experience, you know, you have that firsthand experience, and so you're willing to make changes because you see it. And that's one way that I've been working with, a grassroots effort.
Michael Notaro?
Yeah, similar to what Catherine's saying, I'm on a project that was funded by the Baldwin Foundation along with Rose Pertzborn. And up north, we've been working with some schools in Butternut, Wisconsin. And the goal of that project that we recently started is to basically educate teachers to implement climate investigation in their classrooms, hands-on climate investigations to study the atmosphere, the hydrosphere, biosphere or life, and soils. So in which we're providing instrumentation so that the students can measure local changes in their climate and try to understand how they're affecting their local region. So in other words, kind of really addressing our future generations to get them to really investigate how is global climate change affecting their region and what could be done about it. And we plan to expand that to other schools across Wisconsin. But as another source of encouragement, we know at the federal level things are not going well. It's an understatement. We withdrew from the Paris Agreement, only country that's done that. But if you look at the local level, we see mayors all across the country stepping up and saying, well, if the federal government won't do it, we will. So things can still happen. The other thing to keep in mind is even if the politics or our government doesn't make these changes, we can make decisions and make changes on our own. So we don't need to fully rely on the federal government. States, cities, communities can make changes.
Well, here in Wisconsin, Governor Walker eliminated the jobs of climate scientists who were working at the DNR. He scrubbed references to climate change from the DNR website. In 2015, there were 66 full-time positions that were eliminated from the DNR. And targeted specifically was the Bureau of Scientific Services, which uses objective science based on information to direct policy for natural resources. You can also point to the fact that he put restrictions on Wisconsin's wind energy industry, and now while neighboring Iowa is using wind to generate 35% of its electricity, Wisconsin is generating a paltry 2.4% through wind power. So, Catherine, we see the effects of this locally as well.
Pardon me?
We see the effects of this locally as well.
Yes.
So, Michael Notaro, how do you get through to politicians at the state level and at the federal level?
Oh, that's a tough question. it's become so politicized. I know for ourselves, I'm an associate director of the Center for Climatic Research, and no matter who's in government, our center for about 55 years now is plowing ahead with solid research, and we're doing the work one way or the other. It's harder to get funding, but we're still doing that work. I think the voters really need to make it clear to their local politicians that their state resources, whether it's financial, whether it's ecological, societal, are very vulnerable to climate change. And if they don't do anything, their impacts are going to be financially and socially expensive. Businesses need to understand that. More and more, we're being contacted by groups such as Alliant Energy, They were building a new plant in Beloit. They wanted a climate assessment produced. So businesses are more and more regularly recognizing this. This needs to happen on the government level also, because we need a combination of mitigation and adaptation in order to effectively tackle this ongoing issue.
Today on Route 51, the subject is climate change and how it's affecting the world and our ecosystems in north central Wisconsin with Michael Notaro of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison and Catherine Clancy of UW-Stevens Point's College of Natural Resources. I'm Glenn Moberg. That phone number again is 1-800-780-9742. We're going to take a short break, and here's a song called Apocalypse Lullaby by the Waylon Jennies.
Hurricanes welcome. Earthquakes break the walls. Oceans rise. Empires fall.
Company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. Then they rode it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauled it away.
John Prine with his song about coal country mountaintop removal, taking us into our next segment of Route 51 with Michael Notaro of UW-Madison's Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research and Catherine Clancy of the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. Michael, how vital is it, do you think, that we wean ourselves off of fossil fuels like coal and switch to alternate energy sources like solar and wind?
Obviously, that's going to be critical. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, emissions of carbon dioxide from fossil fuel combustion and industrial processes caused almost about 80% of total greenhouse gas emissions. And there's been a study and shows that if we want to keep our warming less than 2 degrees Celsius, we need to reduce our emissions by the middle of the century by about 50%, and by the end of the century by down to close to zero. Keep in mind, as a caveat, we're already committed to warming. In essence, these greenhouse gases that we've emitted stay in the atmosphere a very long time, sometimes decades. So even if we stopped emissions right now, the Earth is going to continue to warm a certain amount. The burning of fossil fuels has been the main source of the warming that we've experienced over the last, say, 50 years or so, since the pre-industrial era, dating back 150 years. And that has to be tackled. And there are solutions, as you've alluded to, and those need to be implemented at a large scale.
Catherine?
Well, I think that that's, of course, definitely something that we need to focus on. I think if you look over in Europe, they have expanded their green technology, and we are lagging far behind. And so we can actually find economically viable ways of introducing this into our economy. And it would be better if we did it sooner than later.
We've got a couple of phone calls on the same topic here. I think I'm going to take these back to back. Let's go first to Dan in Stevens Point. Dan, you're on Route 51.
Thank you so much, Glenn, and thank you to your guests also for addressing this critical issue that we're all facing. Your last caller talked about the need to have individual action, and it's true. And Professor Clancy also talked about a grassroots project she's involved with. We do need grassroots action. We have to do what we can to reduce our emissions in our households and our communities. But we're also going to need action on the national level. And despite the discouraging news out of Washington and, for that matter, out of Madison, there are things being done. I am heartened by the Climate Solutions Caucus in the House of Representatives, for example, which has grown several-fold in the past year or two. It now has 86 members of the House of Representatives in the Climate Solutions Caucus. 43 of them are Republicans, and 43 of them are Democrats. That bodes well for our getting political collaboration on this critical issue. Here on the local level, Stevens Point, as well as La Crosse and Eau Claire, have passed resolutions supporting something called carbon fee and dividend, which is a way of putting a price on carbon because we have to get the carbon out of our atmosphere. We have actions also being taken by the Midwest Renewable Energy Association here in Portage County, which are wonderful as well. At the state level, we're also working on actions. And by we, I mean I'm a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and we have 20-some chapters here in the state of Wisconsin, 400 chapters around the nation, all of us working at the grassroots level with our representatives, with our city councils and our county boards to get action taken on getting the carbon out of our atmosphere. And
Dan, we got it. You've given us a lot of different resources that people can pursue, and thank you so much for your phone call. Let's go to Teresa in Eagle River. Teresa, you're on Route 51.
Hi. Thank you all for being there. This is all critically important. I'm 69. I have farmed for a long time. I have a farm in Eagle River, and this is critical. And the bottom line is power, greed, and that tension from their House of Representatives, the Senate, whatever. Look at Baylor. We need to vote, and we need to vote them all out. At this time, there's only one person that I will vote for in any of it, and right now, that's Tammy Baldwin. And as far as the rest, vote them all out, and you don't know how many people that are my age that are going to do it, and they're just, we don't know if there's an organization like yours up here in Oneida County or Vilas County, but boy, we need one because it's all about money and greed. And I thank you guys for everything, and God bless.
All right, Teresa, thank you so much for the phone call. And Michael, if you could just comment on the two callers that we just had.
Well, first, I wanted to particularly mention thank you for the Citizens Climate Lobby, the efforts that you're making. I'm glad that that's going. I also want to comment these efforts to try to mitigate greenhouse gases are very critical. There's also another equally important effort called adaptation. That's been the focus of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, and which is a collaboration between the UW system, the DNR, and many other federal, state, and local organizations and private businesses. And our goal is to, in essence, recognize climate's changing and then to adapt our resources so that they are not negatively impacted. And that could sometime look at maybe making assessments, such as a lot of the tribes have been doing, using assisted migration of plant species, analyzing infrastructures, expanding infrastructures so they can handle heavy rain events, perhaps planting more tree cover along streams to produce reduced warming and protect cold water fish. These are also critical because we know ultimately the climate has already changed. It's continuing to change. So we need an equal balance of both the mitigation and adaptation.
Catherine?
Well, as we're losing, you know, for instance, trout streams, all that Michael said was very helpful. But also to basically do sort of a triage of what areas need to be protected, what we can protect, and because we will be losing some. And if you cannot, with the limited resources we have, we can't protect everything. But it also takes resources to determine.
Well, I want to get into this whole area of what people are doing locally to mitigate the impact of climate change, if not solving the problem. One of the big problems is phosphorus runoff, which creates those blue-green algae blooms that we've seen not only in Lake Superior, but along the entire Wisconsin River flowage. The DNR is taking aggressive steps to limit agricultural runoff, and largely because of heavy catastrophic rains like the ones we've seen this past week and last in Wisconsin. We're going to listen to a short feature story I produced last fall on this very topic, and I want to get your reactions on the other side.
I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues.
There aren't many people left that still remember the Dust Bowl when drought and poor farming practices led to a loss of millions of acres of topsoil. Historian Jerry Apps grew up on a farm in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin.
I recall from my childhood the dust storms that visited this part of Wisconsin. They were fierce. They were terrible.
App says the dust storms led to new conservation practices that still mark the local landscape.
People began seeing the need to plant windbreaks to stop the winds blowing from the west and tearing up the sandy soil and moving it east.
Some scientists say that climate change is bringing back drought and dust storms to the western states. But in Wisconsin, the warming climate is instead producing more frequent heavy rains. That's according to a study by the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, which predicts that the amount of topsoil washed away each year could more than double by 2050.
When you have a 9-inch rain event in 3 hours, is that climate change or is that just weather?
Don Ratke is the farm operations manager at North Central Technical College's Agriculture Center for Excellence, a working farm and hands-on classroom north of Wausau. Ratke worries about the erosion caused when too much rain falls too quickly.
Once the soil is saturated, it's almost like falling on cement or blacktop. It's going to run off.
The students here are learning about erosion. The Ag Center has joined the Soil Health Partnership, an initiative of the National Corn Growers Association. The goal is to improve and preserve topsoil, according to crop science instructor Steve Krieger.
So if we can put something in the soil, some kind of a root structure, and keep it there.
Krieger says that by not preserving root structure, some farms are losing 3 tons of topsoil per acre every year.
3 tons is a pretty big pile of soil, correct? So what we're really trying to do is not ship all of our dirt down the Mississippi River and put it in the Delta.
To stop erosion, the Ag Center is teaching the farmers of tomorrow about no-till and cover crop agriculture. Ratke says that means not plowing up the soil and planting a second crop in the fall.
When we take our corn off, we usually put a cover crop of some type on just so there's something always growing in the soil. We try to plant winter wheat, winter rye that'll survive over the winter.
Steve Krieger says that like the windbreaks that followed the dry Dust Bowl years, new techniques can keep soil in place even if we are heading toward a wetter climate.
When we look back to the great Dust Bowls, you'll see a lot of pine tree rows to try to keep the soil down. What we're doing with this whole process is we're putting something on top of the soil to make sure it doesn't move.
These dusty blues.
And he says that makes sense regardless of what the future holds.
I can't control climate change, but we can control erosion just through our farming practices.
Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News. And if you just joined us, we're talking about climate change and its local impacts with Michael Notaro of UW-Madison and Catherine Clancy of UW-Stevens Point. Catherine, 3.5 tons of topsoil per acre every year. That's what a lot of farms are losing. That's a lot of soil.
Yes, especially if you think about how long it takes to form soil. It takes easily over close to a century to form an inch of soil or less.
And, Michael, the comparison between what happened in the 30s, we had the Dust Bowl, we had drought, we had wind, and now the problem seems to be heavy rains.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the heavy rains are definitely increasing, and those are producing those runoffs of phosphorus and nitrogen. But then at the same time, we're experiencing more frequent dry days. So quite likely, you may end up with drier soils. But when you have these heavy rain events, you have extreme runoff. So it's a combination. And I also should mention in regard to some of these efforts to protect the soils and avoid erosion and runoff, that also goes back to the wetlands, loss of wetlands. Those wetlands also protect and reduce some of that runoff. So that's another area that we need to protect.
Your reaction to the fact that farmers locally and across the state of Wisconsin are apparently doing something about this, Catherine?
Well, one of the things that I find amazing is when people will take action on their own to mitigate impacts that they see far away. Another particularly helpful erosion control method is rotation grazing. And so dairy farms that do that substantially, like it's almost like 90% reduction in erosion.
Now, Michael, have you seen other local examples you can give us, examples in Wisconsin of people working to mitigate the impact of climate change?
I think the groups that really most impressed me actually is most of our state's tribal organizations. We've worked with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, also Menominee, Potawatomi, a number of these groups. And they're really passionate and moving ahead and developing assessments on their natural resources and how climate change is impacting it and what to do about it. In case, for example, they're concerned about their maple syrup supply, wild rice or manumen, some of the assorted animals that they consider sacred. And they really have treated the problem very serious, and they've really started developing adaptation strategies. And partly their challenges are greater than a lot of people because, in essence, they're landlocked, where they have less ability to just shift their resources to other locations geographically. So I would say that group that particularly stands out. I know the DNR has done quite a bit of work investigating potential ways to protect fish within streams, for example. But I would say overall, the area of adaptation, where as a country, as a state, we need to move ahead on that. We're pretty far behind. We really need to move our planning ideas into action and start trying to see what works, what doesn't work.
Today on Route 51, the subject is climate change, how it's affecting the world and our ecosystems in north central Wisconsin. Our guests are Michael Notaro of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison and Catherine Clancy, professor of water resources at the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take a short break. Here's David Johansson and the Ink Spots.
People in a party, hot, hot, hot. People in a party, hot, hot, hot. They come to the party, know what they got. They come to the party, know what they got. I'm hot, you're hot. He's hot, she's hot. I'm hot, you're hot. He's hot, she's hot.
I have reached the goal I'm dreaming of. Believe me, I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart.
I had lived here before, oh, in the days of ice. So of course this is why I'm so concerned about the earth. I came back to find that the stars are misplaced and the smell of a world that's burned. And the smell of a world that's burned.
Ricky Lee Jones doing a Jimi Hendrix tune. It's a song about aliens shocked at what we're doing to our own planet. Taking us into our final segment of Route 51 with our guest, Michael Notaro of UW-Madison's Nelson Institute Center for Climate Research and Catherine Clancy of the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. If you want to give us a quick phone call, we might be able to squeeze one more in, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Catherine, Michael was just talking about Native Americans and the upfront role that they've been playing in protecting the environment. You dealt with Native American tribes in your studies of Lake Superior.
A little bit, mostly about invasive species and how they view invasive species a little bit differently. But yes, they are taking an extremely proactive role towards climate change and just the environment in general. Because they are, as Michael mentioned, landlocked, and they don't have a place anywhere else to go.
And this is, as you mentioned, affecting wild rice beds. It's affecting trout streams. How much at risk are our trout streams, Catherine?
Well, with just a 1 degree increase in water temperature, we reduce our trout streams, the brook trout streams, by 73%, according to a study by Mitro and Leon from the Wisconsin DNR. And 3 degrees Celsius, something like 98% of our trout streams are gone. And so if we could, you know, and we placed economic value on these. But it's not just the focus is not just on the temperature. Everything that Michael has talked about with the soil being drier and having more runoff and putting more sediment into the streams that enhances the warming in the streams. And so it's not just going to be affected by air temperature.
And I believe we've got a caller right now, if we can process this caller in a hurry because we're running out of time. Harold in northern Wisconsin wants to talk about the recent rainfall. Harold, you're on the air right now on Route 51.
Talking about these epic rainstorms of the last couple of weeks is, I think, just a snapshot of the potential for what's going to happen in southeast Wisconsin with the when you consider all the hard surfaces of the rooftops, the roads and parking lots and so on caused by the Foxconn project. I think the, you know, the potential there for serious damage is just, we're just beginning to get a quick look at it.
Thank you so much, Harold. Michael Notaro, we see a lot of development. We see the loss of wetlands, and we see increasing heavy rain events. Not a very good prescription for the future.
No, not. And a lot of the research at UW by Ken Potter and Dan Wright has really looked at something called storm transposition. So if these heavy rain events happen over major cities like Madison, as we've seen, or Milwaukee, you know, what is going to happen with these impervious surfaces? So it's definitely a serious issue, and we have to be prepared for.
Those of us who live in northern Wisconsin have noticed that many of our winters are not very wintry anymore. The snow comes late. It comes too late for the deer hunters who like the snow to track the deer. The snowmobile trails aren't open during much of the year anymore. It affects skiers. This could also affect a pretty big tourist economy, Catherine Clancy.
Yes, and in particular, if you have no, you know, like if you like cross-country skiing or something that requires that snow cover and it's all fragmented, it's very difficult. Also, other impacts would be like, for instance, ice fishing. If there's not enough, you know, ice fishing, the thickness of the ice, the safety, et cetera.
Now you can have more of those suburbans falling through the ice
yes.
at an earlier time. It's a joke in television newsrooms, the first suburban through the ice story. Michael, we're down to our last 30 seconds or a minute right now. Why don't I start with you, Catherine? Anything you'd like to say to wrap things up?
Well, I think it is important to know about this topic, but I think it's also important to share some of the successes and the ways that we can be successful to basically encourage people.
Michael Notaro?
This basically want to convey the fact that this enhanced greenhouse effect is well established scientifically. This is ongoing change that's been going on. This is not something that's going to happen. Just look at the planet Venus. There's a reason why it's hotter than Mercury. It has a lot of greenhouse gases. For a century now, we've understood that these greenhouse gases directly affect our Earth. It's not debated.
All right. Very good. Thank you both for being with us today. We want to thank today's guests, Michael Notaro, Associate Director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison, and Catherine Clancy, Professor of Water Resources at the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. I'm Glenn Mobrig of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jana Schleiss. Today is her last day at Route 51, and in our Wausau Bureau, we wish her well on her new adventure in Madison as producer for the morning show on the Ideas Network. And Jana, we will miss you. Thanks also to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Sammy Hagar, Spirit, the Waylon Jennies, John Prine, David Johansson, the Ink Spots, Ricky Lee Jones, and the Police. Next week on Route 51, we look at the drive for diversity in North Central Wisconsin and the push to put minority members in public office and on corporate boards. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.